The room's pretty much full. I think we're still a minute early, but it's full, so we're going to start, I think. So good afternoon. Thank you so very much for coming. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to come to my session. My name is Josh Heller. I'm a senior product manager on the team that supports a bunch of different products. We're called the Enterprise Client Marketing Team. Did anybody in the room today go to the Consumerization of IT Foundation session yesterday? The one in the big forum room? Wow, lots of you guys. Cool. Okay. So that team that put on that session, I was actually in the front of the room. I helped support that. That's my team. So we're all about supporting our friends, the IT pros, as you guys. In fact, show of hands, who counts themselves as like an IT person versus like a partner? So lots of IT people. Awesome. So our team is all about supporting IT pros as they work with, you know, their customers, who are in turn also our customers, to enable consumerization of IT scenarios. A big part of that, as you saw from the presentation yesterday, is solving the problem of data security. How do we keep the data that lives on our infrastructure safe? You may remember that we talked a little bit yesterday in that forum session about, very briefly, about a technology called dynamic access control. And we also talked about a technology called rights management services. These are two technologies we're going to spend some time talking about today. This is meant to be an overview session. So it's fairly high level. This is to give you a taste of what you can do with Microsoft technology. And then at the end, I'll give you some information on more sessions if you want to learn more about the things that we're talking about today. Now, I have a horrible habit of speaking very quickly when I get excited about something. And this is cool stuff. I really like this. So if I am going too fast, I'm going to do as much as I can to not speak too quickly. But if I do, please don't feel bad about yelling at me. I take criticism well. Anyway, so thanks again for being here. What we're here to talk about is information protection, and we're going to split this into two different parts. First, we're going to talk about the problem. In other words, what's changed? Why is this different now than it was, 3 years ago? We're also going to spend some time talking about ways that, sort of how Microsoft looks at information security and data protection holistically. How do we view the problem and sort of address it at a high level? And then we're going to spend some time talking about two specific solutions that we've got that can help you as IT pros help add information security and information protection to your environments. And again, we're going to be talking specifically about dynamic access control and Active Directory rights management services. Real quickly, I know that nobody's using dynamic access control in their environments, at least in production. Is anybody in here already using Active Directory rights management services, even just in a pilot or a small environment? Anybody? Cool, a couple of people. Okay, this is going to be fun. Okay, so to start off, the reason this is different is your jobs are changing. There are new demands being placed on you as IT people. The biggest one, and all of these kind of roll up into this, is this notion of the consumerization of IT. And for anybody that sat through the forum session yesterday, this is going to be a little bit of review, because we spent a lot of time talking about consumerization of IT. But this is this new trend where we see that the end users are actually driving a lot of the velocity or a lot of the speed of IT change. It used to be IT was very able to set standards. This is how users will work. And users accepted it, maybe with some friction, maybe with some complaint, but they accepted it. With the advent of new technologies, as we start to get consumer-oriented devices, so smartphones that are affordable to consumers, tablets that are affordable to consumers, and people are bringing in many of these different devices, IT is now being forced to deal with this. This has put a huge strain on how IT deals with new services. Specific to data protection, it also offers a lot of new challenges as far as where the data that the organization owns lives. And we'll spend some time on that when we get down to cloud computing. The threat itself is also changing. And when we used to, so my career has generally been based around, infrastructure and security with a slant towards identity. And the threat has changed over time. Where I used to spend a lot of time talking to people in a previous life about network security and, how to implement strong firewall policy. That was in the day when we were dealing with people, malicious threats who were on the internet looking for random targets, doing port scans, looking for people who made mistakes in configuring a firewall, who made mistakes in configuring an edge server. That still exists, but the problem's grown, because not only do we have issues where people are still randomly trying to find, vulnerabilities, but we also have people that are specifically targeting organizations based on the type of data that they have. I work at Microsoft, and Microsoft is one of the single biggest targets on the internet. I work on a group at Microsoft that actually sort of looks at security strategy holistically. So security strategy as a whole, as we talk to our customers. And part of what we do there is I work with Microsoft IT and talk to Microsoft's own internal IT department about how do we deal with security threats. And the size of the threat that we deal with is staggering just because of who we are. Many of you, I'm guessing, are also in organizations where because of the data, because of the types of information that you work with, you're particularly vulnerable. Governmental agencies, usually a huge source of that, but also any name brand company. Companies that are just known and have certain types of customer information, certain types of employee information, or specific targets. So the threat itself is evolving because now, instead of people looking for random opportunities on the internet, you have people that are specifically targeting you because of the type of data that you have. That leads to a much more persistent, dedicated attack. Following along with that is the expanding importance of identity. This is near and dear to me. This is what I spend most of my day working on, which is, you know, looking at how we think of identity. So we all individually have an identity. We are who we are. We also have many electronic identities. So we all have a corporate, at least one corporate identity. I'm guessing almost everybody in here uses Active Directory, right? We always love to ask that question because everybody's hands go up. Everybody in here is using Active Directory. I'm guessing many of you have line of business systems like SAP, where you've also got an ID there. You may have other applications like an HR system with another ID. This has been the problem for a long time, and Microsoft spends a lot of time trying to help organizations manage those identities better. But we've, you know, along with this notion of consumerization of IT, now we also have identities for our consumer email. I've got my, you know, Hotmail account. I might have an account on something like Dropbox or Box.net, one of these cloud storage services. I can have an ID for, you know, YouTube. I have all these different IDs, and I have to manage them. And what happens is we get asked to look at managing all these different IDs as end users. End users look for the simplest solution to that, which is bad passwords and bad account control. If we can help solve the problem of identity and all these dispersed identities and give people a singular identity, it makes it easier for them to manage, which makes building in good user and identity policy simpler. But IT, unfortunately, is being asked to deal with this, and not only just in the corporate sense, but also in the consumer sense. Cloud computing, which is kind of the opposite of consumerization of IT. With consumerization, we spend a lot of time talking about devices, all the different devices that your end users are bringing into work, tablets, your phone, an extra laptop that they happen to own at home because they want to be able to check their corporate email on their laptop at home. Well, cloud computing is sort of the other side of it. Now we don't have the device proliferation. We have service proliferation. We have services that the organization themselves are going to subscribe to. You may use SAP on-prem. You may also use SAP coming from, you know, delivered as a cloud service. You might use something like Microsoft Dynamics, which is delivered as a cloud service. You might use Windows Azure, which is a cloud service. There's all these different cloud services. So not only do you have data dispersion downward, you've got data dispersion upwards. And this barely even scratches the surface of the issue where your data may not only live in those cloud services that your IT departments have deemed official, accepted, but you also have the issue where this data can be shared with non-commercial services. They, you know, somebody can put sensitive data up on SkyDrive. We're very honest about saying SkyDrive is not an enterprise service. SkyDrive is a fantastic file sharing tool for consumers. It's not targeted towards enterprises. But that doesn't stop end users from trying to use it that way because they see it as convenient. So we have to look differently at how we actually control data as it's pushed there. And then finally, governmental interests. And this is one that every audience I talk to, no matter where I am in the world, it's a slightly different conversation. Governments have always been involved in security, but typically governments and, you know, industry regulations are geared more towards physical security. You know, how do they keep their citizenship safe? How do they keep their, you know, in-country commerce protected and thriving? Now we see governmental regulations spreading into e-commerce. You know, how do we keep, you know, electronic interests safe as well? And this is putting all sorts of new demands on IT because in Europe, the rest of the world, as well as North America, governments aren't necessarily the most efficient provider of policy. But we're asked to comply with it, so it adds challenge. So this is meant to sort of frame the conversation to give you an idea of why are we looking at data protection differently? Why is the problem different than anything we've seen before? Okay. So I mentioned earlier, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this advanced persistent threat, and this is sort of woven through the entire presentation. And I'm not going to go through every single one of these, but this is meant to sort of show that, you know, when we look for examples of, you know, threats in the environment, it's not hard to find them. And what we're finding is, you know, back to this idea of a persistent threat, we're not finding threats where somebody made a stupid mistake and let data out. We're finding issues where people are very specifically going after particular information. Every single one of the examples that I just flipped through is an example of data being lost because somebody wanted that specific data. This wasn't generally an example of, you know, a USB stick being left on a chair at the airport. It certainly happens, and we want to protect against that. But this is a much more dangerous threat because this is somebody that actively wants information, and they will take it. Information privacy right now is the single most important security concern in the enterprise. This is a huge statement to make. Because it seems like every couple of years we make the statement and it changes a little bit differently. And I think that's a good thing. I think it means that we've pushed back on the threat of 2 years ago and we're looking at a new threat and how do we solve that? And that's why we're here. A couple of years ago we were talking about malware. That was the single biggest issue. How do you keep viruses, malware, rootkits, things like that out of your enterprise? I think we've done a good job as Microsoft trying to help our customers, you know, solve that problem. Now we're looking at how do we equip our customers with the tools to solve information privacy. Keep the information safe, because that's what it's really all about. So how does this happen? How does the data get out? This is a little bit of an eye chart. There's lots of numbers. You guys will obviously have all these slides afterwards, and this is being recorded, so you guys can play it back. But basically, we look at it a few different places. These are both public studies. We didn't do these studies. These are third-party studies, where we took a look at, you know, what's the cause of the data breach and what's the source of the data breach. So in this case, we see current employees, former employees, and customers represent the vast majority of known data breaches. You can see that the numbers have changed slightly over time, but current employees and, you know, hackers are still definitely an issue. What's super, super scary to me when I look at this is that last row on the column on your left, the unknown. 34%, which is at least down from 39%, 34% of the data breaches have an unknown origin, which is really scary. How do we not know how this data got out? We know that we lost data, but we don't know how it got out. And that's a really, really scary thing. And it sort of goes back to the point of you want to protect your systems from threat to begin with, but it's equally as important to protect the data that lives on them so that with the expectation that it's going to get out. Protect your data as though you know it's going to get out of your environment. That way it's still protected. We also looked at how it gets lost. 30% of the loss is due to portable devices, whether it's a smartphone, a laptop, a USB key, a USB drive. Something else people don't think of very often is offline data sources. So how many people in here are at organizations using some type of virtualization technology, whether it's, you know, Hyper-V, whether it's VMware, something like that? I'm guessing almost everybody. Okay. This is one of those fun areas that I talk to a lot of companies about because I also spend a lot of time working on Hyper-V-specific security. We've done a really, really good job helping you secure Windows as it runs live. What a lot of people forget about is sort of the offline representation of that. You know, so people we back up our machines. Do we secure those backup tapes? We run in virtual machines. Do we secure the systems that those machines are running on? Do we secure the VHD files that we might save in snapshot for offline use? These are all representations of your organizational data that needs to be kept safe. As far as the percentage of the cause, negligence is really, really scary for me because negligence means that it's very, very preventable. This is just mistakes that are made. What's interesting is this isn't negligence due to laziness. This is negligence due to a myriad of different reasons, including laziness. But the negligence piece is interesting because what we need to do is work harder at putting controls in place so that even if people are negligent, there's safety nets below it to catch those mistakes. So what I look at is two things. I look at changing behaviors. How can we help our end users collectively, change their use patterns so that they're better about protecting their data? But with the expectations that they won't, how can we build systems in place to protect that data even when they forget? Okay? Does this all make sense? Does this like resonate a little bit? Okay. Cool. We're also seeing an increasing loss from external collaboration. We live in a world where it's expected that we're going to work with partners. Microsoft works with thousands of partners all around the world. We love that. It's great. It helps us scale. It makes us a better company. The challenge is that as we have a growing partnership, our partnerships grow, we need to share data with them. It's expected. We can't keep all of our data locked within walls. There's another presentation that I do a lot in Redmond for customers that come in around sort of the changing face of the enterprise. And I used to use a drawing of a medieval castle. And within the castle, you have this big, big, heavy stone building, and you had walls around that building. And this is an analogy back to the days when I was doing network security, because I could build a firewall, I can put everything I cared about inside that firewall and let very few things in and very few things out, and I felt protected. The problem is that that doesn't adapt to the way that people work today. It's back to that notion of consumerization of IT. Your employees expect to be able to work from home and from the airport and from the hotel. Your business partners expect to be able to work from their offices. They shouldn't have to come to your office to work. They should be able to work from their offices. So the point is being productive, but being productive safely. So this expectation that external collaboration is a good thing. We're not saying don't work with external collaborators. We're saying let us help you work with external collaborators safely. And all the technology we're going to talk about today at a high level are some options that we've got to help you do that. So this all sums up into what we call information protection. There's a lot of different ways to talk about this, and And if anybody's curious, like, I love to talk about this stuff, and we don't have anywhere near enough time today to do it, but I'll be down in the booth most of the week, so you guys can catch me down there if you want to talk more about any of this stuff. But information protection as a whole, I like to sum it up this way. It's about discovering, protecting, and managing your confidential data throughout your business with a solution, and this is the important part, integrated into the platform and the applications. The harder it is to apply information protection, the harder it is to secure your data, the less likely it is that users will do it. The easier we make it, the more likely it is to happen. We look at three themes to do this. It's protecting everywhere, but allowing access from anywhere. We want to protect that critical data wherever it goes. If I've got critical data that lives in a file server, we need to keep that safe. And that's pretty simple to do. We can do that. We've had those tools for a long time. However, we want to protect that data wherever it ends up residing. So if it resides on a backup tape, I want to make sure that data is secure. If somebody downloads that data to their personal laptop so they can work on it on a plane, I want to make sure that data is secure. And it's also about securing the endpoints to reduce the risk. At Microsoft, the requirement is if you have a Microsoft laptop, it has to have BitLocker on it. Who here has an organization using BitLocker or any endpoint encryption tool? Awesome. That's really, really good to see. It's funny. We talk a lot about differences. So I did almost this exact same presentation in North America 2 weeks ago. And I asked that exact same question. And I get far fewer hands. So it's really, really refreshing to see so many people using tools like BitLocker. That's a very good thing. But it's one layer. We want to make sure that you're not only encrypting the endpoint, but you're also protecting the data that lives in that encrypted endpoint. Because the data is not stationary. Data moves around. Data moves all over the place. So we want to make sure the data is protected at rest, but also in flight. Protect it everywhere, but allow access from anywhere. It's about integrating and extending security. Again, we want to allow collaboration with business partners, but we want to make sure that that collaboration is happening safely using confidential channels. So how can we give you tools to enable that? We want to make sure it's built into the Windows platform and Microsoft applications. We don't want to have you, you know, go out and purchase strange third-party applications that are going to be foreign to end users. Worse than purchasing is the cost of training your end users. How do we make it simple for your end users to use this? Because, again, the harder it is for your end users to use, the less likely it is that they'll do it. I drive engineering teams nuts because I count mouse clicks. I'm like, well, to do X, it takes me 5 mouse clicks. It should take me 2. Why? Because, again, the more times we're asking end users to click a mouse, the less likely it is that they'll ever do it. And if you force them to do it, it breeds resentment and dislike for IT, which I don't like either. And then finally, simplifying security and then managing compliance. How do we simplify the deployment and ongoing management? Because not only is it critical to make it easy for the end users to use, but we know that our IT pros, you guys, have really, really hard jobs. You're asked to work with a lot of different technologies and all of your different end users and keeping them happy while also keeping your organizational leadership happy. How can we give you tools not only to make it easier for the end users, but also easier for yourselves? How can we make it simple for you to deploy and manage this technology? And then finally, enabling compliance with information security policy. I'm a big fan of writing security policy and then hoping and then trusting that the technology that I'm using to enforce that technology complies to it. One of my pet peeves is when I've got a policy and I've got to change that policy because of the technology I'm using. It drives me crazy. It shouldn't work that way. Your business should be able to write policy the way that they want, and then we should be able to build technology for you that adapts that policy. Okay? So these are the three themes that we try to honor as we go through and build information protection solutions. The first technology we're going to talk about that will help us on this journey, and no one technology is a full solution. All of these things have to work together, along with technologies we don't even have time to talk about today, but it's all about a layered defense or a layered approach. The first one we're going to talk about today is Active Directory Rights Management Services. For anybody that is already using ADRMS, this is going to be very simple. I'm giving you a very high-level overview of the use cases. We're going to go through a little bit of how it works, but not in any great detail. I think there's a deep dive session on ADRMS this week. If there's not, and anybody wants to talk more about RMS, stop down in the expo. So ADRMS, for anybody that is not familiar with it, it's all about providing identity-based protection for sensitive data. So this is important. There are a lot of solutions on the market that will let you encrypt a file, which is great. Encrypting a file typically has some sort of identity requirement to it. If you're going to open this, you have to prove who you are, and that can be done in one of many ways. Within ADRMS, we try to keep this simple. We don't want people to have to do things like remembering private and public keys. We want to use the identity that's already in place, because those public and private keys are yet another identity we have to manage. If we can use this alongside of Active Directory and use your Active Directory identity as the key that opens up the data, that's a good thing. It's also about applying policy. So we're not only saying, yes, you can open it, or no, you can't open it. We're saying, yes, you can open it, but here's what you can do with it. Maybe you can open it, but not change it. Maybe you can view it as an email, but not forward it along. And we'll take a look at some of these examples and demos. It's also about securing the transmission and the storage of sensitive data wherever it goes. So in this case, we're encrypting the data, and even if that data completely leaves the Microsoft ecosystem, somebody takes a very sensitive Word document, copies it out to Dropbox, which has very little, if any, Microsoft technology running it, that document is still encrypted. Nobody can get to that unless that document can come back and talk to the rights management services infrastructure. And then again, embedding those use policies. So I mentioned we can say, yes, you can open it, no, you can't open it, but we can also apply policy. You can open it, but you can't edit it. Or we can say, this file exists and you have access, but after 30 days, it disappears, it vaporizes. That policy gets embedded into the content itself. So again, we're not trusting where it lives. I don't care where the data goes. Once it's protected with ADRMS, it doesn't matter. It can go anywhere. And the ADRMS protection follows it because it's embedded into the document itself. Okay? At the end, ADRMS is about encryption plus a policy, which comprises access permissions, in other words, who can access it, and use right permissions, which is once they access it, what can they do with it. These two things combined together is what we call persistent protection. Real quick, this is how it works. I've got like two different versions of the slide. I'm going through the really simple version today. If anybody's curious about how this actually works under the covers, come down and find me and we'll talk about it. There's two personas or two people that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about an information author and an information recipient. Of course, we can have many recipients. We can have millions of recipients. For this, we're going to talk about one, just to keep things simple. At the top, we have an Active Directory rights management server. Again, we're keeping this really simple. We're assuming you already have Active Directory running, and you just need an ADRMS server, which can run alongside of Active Directory. As an information author, I create a document. That document is an information author I've decided is sensitive information. Maybe it contains credit card numbers. Maybe it contains some sort of personal identification number. I've decided, either way, that it needs to be protected. I need to protect this document so I can control who has access to it. The first thing I'm going to do is within Microsoft Office, because again, all this is built into the Office products, within Microsoft Office, I'm going to contact the Active Directory Rights Management server and say, hey, what can I do? I would like to protect this document. The ADRMS server is going to give me several options. It's going to give me templates, or it's going to let me explicitly define who can access this document and what can they do with it. Once they do that, the document is encrypted and wrapped, and inside of it is wrapped this use policy. At this point, the document on a file system looks like any Word document, or any document. If it's a Word doc, it's going to look like a docx. Can't really tell the difference. Also, you'll see what this looks like a little bit later. But if I try to open it, Word says, hey, you know what? This is a protected file. I can't open this unless you do something with it. If you were to open that docx in some other third-party program that can read Microsoft Word docs, it's going to basically say, I don't know what to do with this. This isn't a valid Word document. So it's protected no matter what. Data is not stationary, though. Once we've protected that document, we're going to do something with it. Maybe we email it. Maybe we put it on a file share. Maybe we put it on a SharePoint site. As that data is transferred, though, to a recipient, a recipient is going to try to consume it. As that recipient tries to consume it, it's going to go back and it's going to talk to the ADRMS server again. It's going to say, hey, I would like to read this. This is who I am. This is my identity. The ADRMS server is going to check and basically say, okay, based on the use license, based on how it's licensed for you to open it, or view it, or edit it. Remember, it's access as well as use rights. Yes, you can go ahead and view it. and it's going to, if you looked, the little lock popped off. What's interesting, and I want to kind of point out, is we never actually unencrypt the document. I'm sort of picturing it as though it just disappears. We never actually do that. The experience to the end user is that we've unencrypted the document. So we've effectively, we're showing the user an unencrypted part of the document. But in the end, the document itself actually stays encrypted, even while the user's viewing it. This is an incredibly simple look at how ADRMS works. Now I want to talk about a couple of use cases that are more popular. So we send emails everywhere. Everybody does. At Microsoft, you know, we make SharePoint, but we still send email attachments to everybody. We also send very sensitive emails to each other. Microsoft trusts me to carry around fairly sensitive information on my smartphone. But to do that, we're pretty careful about using things like rights management to make sure that emails themselves are protected. Most of what we're going to look at here, we're actually going to show in a demo in just a couple minutes. But within Exchange 2010, we have Active Directory Rights Management Services integration. This lets us actually use Exchange as a place of policy to control how emails are sent. Who in here is using Exchange 2010? Lots of people. Cool. So if you guys are using Exchange 2010, you may be able to take advantage of this now. So again, I've got my personas. I've got on the left-hand side, I have, yeah, your left-hand side, I have an information creator. I have an email sender. And on that far right-hand side, I have an email recipient. I'm going to send an email. This email may be a highly confidential email, and I forgot to apply rights protection. This is really common. End users don't think about, I need to apply rights protection. So I'm going to send this email. The Exchange server is going to see it. And we have the ability to use transport rules inside of Exchange 2010 to look at the emails as they go through the email system and say, based on your content, I need to apply protection. I can do things like look for strings. Maybe it's a top secret string, or look for the word confidential in any email. I can also use things like regular expressions. Regular expressions, for anybody who's familiar with it, will make sense. Anybody who's not familiar with regular expressions let us basically create patterns, and those patterns represent things. So a pattern that I could give you is most credit cards, like a Visa or a MasterCard, are 4 characters -4 characters -4 characters -4 characters. Changes. Everybody's got a different credit card number, but the pattern's always the same. Regular expressions let us match any of those patterns. So anytime a pattern comes through an email that looks like a credit card number, or in the United States, we use social security numbers as personal identifiers, and a social security number is 3 characters -2 characters -4. I can look for that type of information and automatically apply protection to it. Out of the box, we've got several different policies that are available, one of which is do not forward. So anytime I see an email that says top secret confidential, I can set that email to automatically not be forwardable. That means that once I receive the email, I can read it, but I can't do anything with it. I can reply to the original sender, but that's it. I can't forward it. I can't print it. I can't save it. I can't even cut and paste from the email. And we'll actually take a look at what this is. As it gets sent to the end user, this gets sent as an encrypted email. Outlook knows how to deal with encrypted email. Outlook Web Access also knows how to deal with encrypted email. And many phone platforms now support this as well. The cool thing with RMS, ADRMS is a great technology. It's also fully extensible. We've got a software development kit that's available on Microsoft's Kinect website that anybody can download. And they can actually write RMS code for your own applications or for third-party devices. I always get a lot of questions about, hey, does my device support ADRMS? The answer to many of those devices is now yes, which is cool because 3 months ago I couldn't say that, but now we can because we've got lots of great partners writing plugins. And we're working with pretty much every major software vendor and device vendor in the world right now on getting RMS support built into their platforms. If anybody's got specific questions about their platform, come grab me at the end and I'm happy to talk about that. Another big use case is SharePoint. So data at rest. How many of you use SharePoint for document repositories? Okay. Cool. Oh, wow. Great. Okay. This works today with SharePoint 2007 and SharePoint 2010. So if you have either of those two versions, this is something you could look at. We can create a library, a document library in SharePoint, and I can tell that document library anything in this library, because maybe it's a sensitive library for a top secret project. Anything in this library automatically should have RMS protection applied to it. Again, as an end user, I don't have to remember to apply protection. I can. I have that option. But if I forget, when it gets to the SharePoint library is going to automatically add RMS protection to it. And the cool thing is that the information within the document is still searchable. So SharePoint still has the ability to actually look in that document and, you know, basically respond to searches for its content. And we'll look at this as well. This is a super simple way to apply rights protection to documents in mass. Last one I wanted to mention is a tool that we're introducing called the Generic File Protection Explorer. I'm guessing almost everybody in here has used like WinZip at some point in their life, or they've worked with cab files. So anytime where you've got an archive, think of it like a big folder that you dump files into. We created this tool called the Generic File Protection Explorer, which lets you take any type of document and apply RMS protection to its container. So we typically talk about applying rights protection to a file. This lets us apply rights protection to a folder, and that folder can contain any information. Out of the box, RMS works with the office documents, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and of course, Outlook emails. There's a handful of other applications out on the market, actually a lot of other applications on the market, where vendors have, partners have built in support for ADRMS. But inevitably, there is an application that you are using in your organization that we don't have support for. This is one solution to that. If you want to securely transmit that information, make sure that it doesn't get out in an unprotected sense, you can use something like generic file protection to put that third-party file into this folder and send it securely. Okay? This is available in beta form. I don't know exactly when this is coming out. I can't remember. But it's one of those things, if you actually search online for generic file protection, you should find the links for this. So let's take a look at ADRMS in a demo. Does that work? All right. Okay. So here we are. We're taking a look. This is my Exchange server. So we're going to look at a couple different scenarios. We're going to look at ADRMS and how this works with emails. And then we're also going to take a look at SharePoint. With Exchange, I'm actually going to show you where this is configured. And then we're going to take a look at the user experience for it. So here I am. I'm on my Exchange 2010 server. And I'm going to go down to the hub transport. The hub transport is where I create things like transport rules. Remember, transport rules are how we take action on emails flowing through Exchange. Okay? Exchange is a great choke point for information, because everybody sends email. So if we can control information as it goes through Exchange, we can protect it. I've created a transport rule, and we'll take a look at that. For anybody in the consumerization of IT session yesterday, do you remember Project Cosmo? Project Cosmo was our top secret project that we were all working on that we couldn't let the information get out. For anybody curious, Cosmo is my dog. That's how we ended up with that name. We just needed a name to use, and Project Cosmo stuck. Within here, I have to do a few different things. I have to set conditions. I have to say, you know what, when do I want to do something? The condition that I've decided to choose is any time I see an email whose subject field or message body contains a string. In this case, I can provide a list of strings. So I've provided one. I provided Project Cosmo. I could create another string in this list called confidential. I could create another string called top secret. I could create as many as I want. I also have the ability to choose regular expressions and do that pattern matching that I talked about earlier. Once we've provided a condition, we need to provide an action. In other words, once we've done this, what do we want to do with it? Because remember, transport rules are very powerful. They're used for all kinds of things besides rights protection. But since we're here to talk about RMS, we're going to talk about how to RMS protect it. So I have the ability to do a rights protected message, and I have to choose a template. You'll notice I've got two options. There's this do not forward option, which comes out of the box as soon as you enable RMS protection with Exchange. And then I have this other option called finance tiered access. And finance tiered access we'll look at again in a few minutes. But finance tiered access is another RMS template that I've created that basically provides lots of access for administrators in finance and very little access for interns in finance or co-op students in finance. I've decided to go ahead and say do not forward. So anytime I send an email with a subject or a message body that contains Project Cosmo, I want to rights protect that and not allow that email to be forwarded. So this is a little snapshot of how this rule looks. And then I can also provide exceptions. I can say do this unless I'm sending it to this particular person or unless the message also contains this string. So I can provide exceptions to the rule as well. So we've got this rule. The next thing I'm going to do is actually flip over to a client and show you what this looks like. I'm going to apologize now. I've got to flip. I only have one client, and I have to log in and out of the client a couple times, so forgive me that. Here we are. There's three people we're going to work with today, and this is true for the RMS demo as well as the demo that we're going to do a little bit later on dynamic access control. We're going to talk about Ben. We're going to talk about Jason, and we're going to talk about Ashley. So Ben, in this case, is a finance administrator. He's been in the finance department a long time. He's an expert worker, and he's kind of like the senior person. We've got Jason, who's similar to Ben, but Jason has also been tasked and tagged by IT to work with IT, sort of as their helper. He's a power user in the finance department that knows a little more about IT than everybody else. And then we also have Ashley. And Ashley, in our example, is a new employee to Contoso Corporation, and Ashley doesn't have any access, and we'll go back to her in a few minutes. Right now, though, we're logged in as Ben. We're going to go to the desktop, and I've opened up Outlook. So I'm here in Outlook, and I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to write a new email. And I'm going to send this email to Ashley. Meeting. Hi, Ashley. Please be at the Project Cosmo launch tomorrow. And I've gone ahead and send that. I'm going to go ahead and send this to Ashley Johnson. So I've created the email. I've sent the email. You notice I didn't do anything. I didn't choose to protect that email. For anybody in here that's already using RMS, you probably know how to protect emails in Exchange. But you'll note that I didn't do that. I just sent the email. I typed it. Project Cosmo is very sensitive. I don't want anybody knowing that there's a Project Cosmo update tomorrow. So now what we're going to do is we're going to log out and we're going to log back in as Ashley. Here I am. I'm logging in as Ashley. I'm going to go to the desktop. Oh, and I've got this email from Ben. Now notice, when I sent the email, I didn't apply RMS protection. But in the couple seconds it took for me to log out and log back in, she's received the email. It doesn't really add any time. And now I've got this new option here, or this new flag here, which basically says do not forward. So recipients, in this case Ashley, can read the message but cannot forward, print, or copy the content. The owner, in this case Ben, still has full rights though. So if I open up this email, and Ashley, being new to the company, doesn't understand what this is. She's like, well, this seems really important. I'm going to forward this to my friend down the hall and ask her what I should do. But she can't forward it because we've set do not forward. So she can't forward it. If you look, if I go to the file menu, there's no way for me to do a save as. There's no way for me to save this document as like a .msg or a .eml file. If I go back to the message and I highlight something, I can't copy or paste it. That's grayed out. So effectively, I've given Ashley the information that she needs to do her job, but I've prevented her from making a mistake and proliferating or disseminating this information farther than it needs to be. Okay? So Ben didn't have to know how to protect an email, but we still managed to send out sensitive information securely. What's that? That's a great question. Depending on the screenshot tool, it's a yes or no question. If the screenshot tool runs in user mode, and this is a little technical, so if this doesn't make sense, grab me afterwards. If the screenshot tool runs in user mode, we can turn it off. If it's a very strange screenshot tool that runs in kernel mode, we can't really. This is why I was saying RMS is never the full solution. It's a part of a solution. So another good practice would be to not allow screenshot tools, which you could, of course, do through group policy. So it's always a collection of technologies together. If somebody really wants to get information disseminated, they can do that. If I really wanted to, I could take a picture of this with my mobile phone. But for anybody in the consumerization of IT session yesterday, you saw how we can use Windows Intune to apply policy to turn off camera phones. So again, and I'm serious, because in a way, it's always a collection of technologies. There's never one thing we can do that will solve the problem for everybody. So it's always about layering the security together, layering policy together to try to solve the problem as best we can. Typically, the harder you make it for somebody to be malicious, the less likely it is for them to follow through. Yes? No. So if I do a reply to all, and I'm trying to think how I have the rule. Sorry, I'm moving mice. I'm trying to think how I've got this. So if I set this to reply to all, you'll notice I can do a reply to all, and Ben's in there. But I don't have the ability to. You can't really see me clicking. But if I'm clicking in the two box, it doesn't actually give me the ability to add anybody. And if I click to, it's just going to sit there and spin for a second, and it's eventually going to come back with an error saying no. And it's basically saying, since I'm the owner, I can only cut or copy my part of the reply, too. So I can do a reply, but if I select this part, I can't copy it. But if I type here, oops. Man. This part I can cut and copy. So we actually protect what I can cut and copy without annoying people and not letting them do copy and pasting of the stuff they type. So it's always about information ownership, where the information originated. Okay? All right. The other thing I wanted to look at is SharePoint. I'm logging as Ashley, but this should still work. I don't normally do this as Ashley, but I think this will be fine. So I'm going to go into Microsoft Word. And I've been told as Ashley, you know, there's a couple different places we keep documents. One of them is in SharePoint. So I'm going to say, oh, Christ. Super secret information. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to save this document. And I'm going to go ahead and save it on my SharePoint server. I think she's in the security group to do this, but we'll see. Okay. I'm going to go into my shared documents folder, and super secret information is going to be the file name, and go ahead and save it. and it's going to save. And let's look at that through a web browser. Here I am, I'm on my SharePoint site, and I see this super secret information. Remember, I created the document, I saved it. I didn't do anything as far as rights protection goes. I'm going to go ahead and open this up. Let me close that one. It's going to think for a second, and if this worked, yeah. We're going to get this prompt, and this prompt basically says, you know what, permission to this document is currently restricted. Office must connect to, and this is my RMS server, my environment, to verify your credentials and download your permissions, because they need to find out what access do I have. So I'm going to say okay. It's going to talk to the RMS server. And now it says super secret information. And I get this prompt that basically says server read only. So basically, the server read only comes from SharePoint. That's normal. Anybody that uses SharePoint's probably familiar with that. And then finance tiered access. And it's basically saying you only have access to this. You only have access through the finance tiered access template. Because I'm the author, I've got full control of this. But if I were to send this out, the policy would apply. It would basically decide who can do what with this. So again, I didn't have to do anything, but RMS protection automatically got applied. Okay? So that's a quick snapshot of a couple of different ways we can apply RMS outside of the traditional method, which is the user having to remember to do it. Like I said, I'm a big fan of getting users to help themselves. If we can help our users help themselves, makes them happier because they're not always calling IT to complain about having to remember to do information rights management, or RMS. At the same time, it also helps you as IT pros because it helps your information that you guys manage stay safer. Okay? The next thing we're going to talk about is dynamic access control. Dynamic access control is it's probably one of my favorite new technologies in Windows Server 2012. I'm a little biased because I'm the product manager for dynamic access control, but it is a very, very cool technology. Everything I'm showing you, by the way, in the demos today, both RMS as well as dynamic access control, is available now. You can do this within the release candidates that are downloadable from Microsoft.com if you wanted to try this in your organization. So dynamic access control is about a few different things. It's about classification. What data do I have? Because we know we've got lots of data, but we don't know what that data is. How do we classify it and decide how sensitive it is? It's about access control. Who should have accessed it? So we have this data out there. How do we know who's accessing it and who should be accessing it? It's about auditing. Once we've given people access, how do we know who has accessed it and how and when? Audit is something super, super critical that nobody ever remembers about. Like, audit's one of those things, I think, because we've made it hard in the past, people tend to ignore. They've tried to solve that as part of dynamic access control. And then finally, it's about protection. So we just finished talking about ADRMS. I've shown you how ADRMS interacts and works with Exchange. This is about showing you how ADRMS interacts and works with our file servers automatically, and we'll talk about this too. So it's about classifying things, controlling access to those files, auditing access to those files, and applying protection to those files, and that's what we're going to talk about. This is a very high-level overview of dynamic access control. Immediately after this session, I think it's immediately afterwards. It might be at 4, actually. At 4 o'clock today, there's another session, which is an overview of dynamic access control, which is going to go a little bit deeper, but it will be some review of what I've already done. And then later today, maybe at 5 o'clock, there's a dynamic access control deep dive. My peer, Matthias, is doing both of those. Matthias is very, very good. He's actually one of the developers, one of the program managers on the team that writes dynamic access control. So if this is interesting, I'll probably plug those sessions again at the end. So classifying. We're going to talk about each of those four things. So classifying information. I have several different ways I can classify information on my file servers. I can classify information based on where it is. So in other words, if it's sitting in a folder, anything in that folder should be called finance information. I can do that. That's classifying information based on location. It's very useful, but it's not what I would consider the total solution. Data moves. As an end user, I might forget and save that finance document in my personal folder. But that doesn't make it, and it doesn't make it not finance data. So I need other ways to look at data. Another way is manual classification. I can manually decide that this particular document is highly sensitive information, highly, highly sensitive information. And there's within the Windows Explorer now. We've got a way to do that, and I'll show you. What I like the most and what we'll actually look at today is what we call contextual classification. And this is where we look at the contents of the file, and based on the contents of the document, assign classification to it. I can look for a document, and anytime I see a credit card number, automatically classify it as highly sensitive. And that's actually what we're going to do today. And then finally, I've got the puzzle pieces representing application. This is because, just like RMS, dynamic access control is very extensible. We've got lots of partners that are building classification tools, and they are also going to have the ability, if you work with those partners, to classify information on your behalf. Okay? The way this works is, as an end user, I create a file and save it on a file server. When I save that file, I'm going to offload this to a classification engine. This looks like two things, but it's not. The classification engine runs on the file server. The classification engine may use the inbox classifier, which, like I said, works with pretty much anything that works with a Windows indexing service and, like, the Office filter packs. If anybody would use those, that's how we do it. Or we can work with those third-party plugins, like I just mentioned. Once the classification engine has determined what its classification should be, it saves that classification back onto the metadata of the file itself, so it's tied to the file. And then the end user doesn't know anything about that. They can look and they can see it, but the end user doesn't have to make a choice. They don't have to decide anything unless you've gone down the path of doing manual classification. So that's sort of a quick snapshot of how classification works. I also mentioned access control. So access control is cool. We've implemented centralized access to files. Today, you control security for your file servers two different ways. You control security using permissions on the share, and you control permissions using you control access using permissions on the files or the folders themselves. Typically, that's tied to things like usernames, or it can be tied to groups. So if you're a member of the finance group in Active Directory, you have access to the finance folder, which contains the finance documents. That's all well and good. It's fine. There's two issues that we tried to solve as part of Windows Server 2012. One of them is that we have to do that on every single file server. Every single folder. So every time I create a new access list, I need to write that access list out. And unless I'm, you know, using nested folders, that can be challenging. The other issue is that groups get stale. Group membership management. How many people in here think that they've got a problem with group membership management? You know, knowing who should be in the groups, who shouldn't be in the groups. Okay. There's lots of tools to help solve this problem, but they all cost money. And it's typically not something that even with the tools is what I consider an easy solution. At the same time, many of you are also using Active Directory. Many of you are probably using Active Directory the way that we'd like you to, which is using all those great attributes. Within Active Directory, we have great attributes, things like the department, things like a user's manager field, things like the country field. Why can't we use that information, or the title field? Why can't we use that information to help make access control decisions? So if my title is finance administrator, I should have full access to all finance information. If my title is finance intern, I should only have access to a subset of that information. So why can't we use that information as part of the access control decision? That's what centralized access to files is all about. These central access policies, I've tried to illustrate here, and I tried to leave it really simple. And I apologize if it's not clear, but what we're looking at on the left-hand side is Active Directory. Within Active Directory, we can now do what's called claims. Claims are really, really simple, and I think we do a really good job overcomplicating it. We don't need to. Claims are really simple. Claims are simply me adding information about you from Active Directory into your logon experience. When I log in, I now can see what department I'm in. I now can see who my manager is. Because that's how that works, we can now use that information to make access control decisions. So an example I gave earlier, I can build an access policy that says, if you want access to finance information that has a high business impact, and you can see that where I've got, on the far right-hand side, file properties, I've got the department equals finance and the file's impact equals high. So if you want access to finance information that has a high business impact, that user must be an employee of the finance department, in other words, have their finance value set as their department. They must have a high security clearance, which is that clearance field, and they have to be using a managed device registered with the finance department. In other words, they can't use, as an example, their iPad to open this information because that can't be a managed device. So this gives you a lot of granular control over who can access information and what type of information. And I'll show this in a demo, and this will get a lot clearer. We've also added a new technology as part of this called Access Denied Remediation. This lets your users more easily solve problems with access. So as an end user, they're going to try to access a file. In Windows 7 and Windows 2008 R2, we gave you an error message, which was generally pretty ugly and not helpful. It was something to the effect of, like, in best case, it was you don't have access. Sometimes it was file can't be found. Now we have the ability to actually show a message back to the user, which basically says, you know what, you don't have access to this information, but click on this link and let's help you fix that access. And we'll take a look at how this happens. There's a lot of different options we have to sort of decide how that happens, but we'll take a look at a couple of them. I mentioned auditing. You can turn on file system audit today. It works very well in Windows 2008 R2. The problem is it's everything. You're going to see all the audit information for all of your files. But oftentimes, that's not what you want. Oftentimes, you just want to see audit information for certain types of information. So why not use that same technology, claims and file properties, to make those determinations? In other words, why not only audit access to files if the file's impact is a high-impact file? Because I don't care about file access to the low-impact stuff. I only want to audit access to the high-impact stuff. So it's about using those claims and using those expressions as part of our audit decisions. And this is all stuff that we're going to go into in the sessions later today as well. Protecting sensitive information was that last field, which is, once we've got this information classified, once we've controlled access to it, how can we protect that information so that if it ever leaves the file server, we know that it's safe? Just like I showed you with Exchange, Exchange had the ability to look at a particular piece of information, and if it matched a rule, it added RMS protection. We have the same ability to do that now on the file servers. So if a user creates a document that gets classified in a certain way, the file server can now automatically contact the rights management server on behalf of the end user and initiate RMS protection, initiate that encryption. The document gets automatically encrypted, and then from there on, the file is protected, whether it stays on the server or whether it leaves the server. Again, removing the need for the end user to always have to remember to add protection. Okay? So let's take a look at how this actually comes together, because I think it's clear through demos. All right. So we're back on this demo system. We're going to use the same basic demo environment that I used a few minutes ago, the same people. I do want to show you one thing first. We're going to go and we'll look at something in Active Directory. So this is the Active Directory Administrative Center. We don't have time to really do a deep dive in this, but if you're Active Directory people and this is at all interesting, stop down in the booth. We were talking about this tool and some other stuff down there. We'd love to talk to you. This is not something that's going to be too unfamiliar. You see your organization. You see all those different organizational units. We've added this here, though. We've added this new section called Dynamic Access Control. Dynamic Access Control is how we configure what we just looked at. Because, again, those central access policies are stored in Active Directory. Those claims that I talked about, in other words, issuing attribute information from Active Directory as part of the logon experience, is configured here. You can see that I'm issuing two different types of claims, or two claims. I'm issuing a country and I'm issuing a department. That means every time I log in as a user in this test environment, I'm going to get claim information as part of my logon experience. It's going to let me make access control decisions based on my country as set in Active Directory and based on my department as set in Active Directory. We also talked about documents. Remember, I was talking about a document being high impact or a document being in the finance department? I've got a couple of these set up already because those resource properties for those documents, again, are stored in Active Directory. We want to store all this stuff centrally. That way it's easier to manage. So I've gone ahead and I've set up the department because you can see some of these are grayed out. They're disabled. I've gone ahead and I've set up a department. I've set up an impact value, and I've set up a personally identifiable information. We combine those things in what we call a central access rule. The central access rule is here. I've created a very, very simple rule for you guys. I've created a rule for the finance department. The finance department rule says a couple different things. It basically says we have defined target resources. What should this rule affect? Because remember, we're defining access policies, but we're not applying them natively or originally to files and folders. We're putting them in Active Directory. So we have to decide on target resources. So what I've said is for any document whose department value is set to finance, okay, we talked about that, go ahead and create some permissions. I've created these permissions here. And I want to call your attention to something. Actually, let's go back a little bit. I've got two permissions here. I've got two permissions. One is allowing authenticated users full control, which seems scary. I've got another one which is allowing authenticated users to read and execute, which shouldn't be, because why could I have two permissions that overlap? Well, what I've done is I've actually extended these by adding conditions. So authenticated users can have full control over that information, but only if their department equals finance. If their department is set to finance intern, they can still get access, but they only get read and execute access. So we have an ability of creating really granular rule sets, again, stored natively in Active Directory. These get pushed out to file servers using group policy. One other thing to call your attention to, you'll notice that this says current permissions. I also have the ability to do what are called proposed permissions. Using this, I can simulate a permission set change. So if I want to add an additional layer of security and lock down my data more, I can make that change today, easily. The problem is that I may cause impact if I make a mistake. What this lets you do is it lets you simulate changes. So you can see if I change permissions, who would still have access and who would lose access. And that's a really powerful tool. Okay? So that's a snapshot of what you can do within Active Directory as part of dynamic access control. The next thing we're going to do is actually move back to the client. Actually, I want to show you one more thing. We're going to take a look at the file server. Here I am. I'm on my file server, and I'm looking at the data drive. I've got a finance folder, and if I look at the properties, you'll notice that there's a new tab. We've got this new tab called classification. If I click on classification, I can see the department value, the department properties value, is set to finance. Again, these here came out of Active Directory, and the value options also get stored in Active Directory. Remember I mentioned one of the options to do classification is manual? In this case, I've manually decided that any information in this folder is automatically going to be a finance document. Something else we've done is on the security tab, we've added some options under advanced. We've got this here called effective access. Effective access lets us look at between share security, file and folder security, and central access policy, what does the permission set actually look like? So I can actually do some simulation. First thing I'm going to do is pick a user, and I'm going to pick my new user, Ashley. So let's look at Ashley Johnson. Actually, you know what? I'm going to change the order of this. We're going to come back to this in a second. Let's first flip over back to the client. I'm actually going to show you what Ashley would do on her first day. So here Ashley's logged in. And her peer told her that, again, remember there's two places she does her work, in SharePoint, and that she can also use this file server. So she's going to go to the file server and actually go to the finance folder. And you'll notice she tried to access it, but she quickly gets an error. Nope, there's a problem accessing file server data finance. You'll notice this error message is brand new. For anybody that uses SharePoint, this looks a little bit familiar. It's because SharePoint did this really well in SharePoint 2010, so we decided to borrow some of it. You'll notice that I've got this message, you don't currently have access to this resource, please use this wizard to request additional access. That message is completely customizable. I typed that in. I decided what that message was. I can even do things like including URLs, so if you wanted to include a URL to redirect them to some sort of site that's going to give them more information, you can do that. What I've decided to do is allow them to use this form to send an email. So Ashley has the option to click and request assistance. So she's like, I am a new employee and need my access set up. And she can go ahead and click send message. We'll see if this works. Okay, and the message gets sent. Now, what's cool is that message can go to anybody. That message doesn't have to go to a help desk. That message, if you remember, I gave you the people earlier. And one of the people I named was Jason, who's that finance power user. He works with IT. So you've actually delegated to Jason the ability to go ahead and set and basically take care of these file access issues. So we're going to sign out of here as Ashley, and we're going to sign in as Jason. So we're logged in as Jason. And up here I am in Outlook. And I'm going to go ahead and click on this. Oh, and I see I got a new email from accesshelp@fileserver.contoso.com, which is how I've got this set up. And you'll see that Jason actually got an email from Ashley, and it's basically saying, you know what? She's saying that she is a new employee and she needs her access set up. And you'll notice that it sums up the different access permissions, and it says that her effective access is blocked, and it says why her access is limited. From here, Jason has the ability to go ahead and change permissions a little bit to give her the access that she needs. But we need to give him tools to do that. So I want to go back to that screen where I just was, and I told you I'd come back. And we're going to take a look. So we're on the finance folder, and we want to say, well, why didn't Ashley have access? Let's figure that out. So we're going to go ahead and select a user, and we're going to pick Ashley, of course. Say OK. And we're going to say, OK, let's look at what her access would be. And you'll notice that just like we saw in the email, all this shows more, she doesn't have access. And the reason she doesn't have access, it says, is the finance department rule, which is her central policy. That's the central policy that comes out of Active Directory. Because, again, we're storing this information in AD. Going back here, again, I can make a decision. You know what? Well, I think that she doesn't have access because maybe she's not a member of the finance group, or maybe she's not a member of the finance department. So I can go ahead and set her claim, because remember we just talked about that claim data? So I can click on department, and I can say, well, what if I set her department value to finance? And now if you look, if I do that, she would have access. So all you need to do now is go into Active Directory and change her attribute, change her department attribute to be finance. Ashley logs off and logs back on. She gets a new logon ticket, and she'll be able to access her documents. So this is a really, really straightforward way to manage access control and access policy centrally. Okay? The next thing we want to look at is some of the automatic classification we talked about. So remember, I talked about how the file server can sort of participate in automatically protecting information and also automatically classifying information. The tool we're looking at here, and you may remember this yesterday if you were in the consumerization session, is the File Server Resource Manager. The File Server Resource Manager is the console that we've implemented within Windows Server to manage your file servers. This looks very similar to the File Server Resource Manager that was in Windows Server 2008 R2. Okay? We've made some changes, though. Within this classification rules under classification management, I can create a rule that automatically classifies my information. We talked about that a few minutes ago. If I open this up, I'm going to first define a scope. In other words, where do I want to look for this data? In this case, I've chosen my data drives. And then I have to actually decide what to do with it. I've got a few different ways to do it. One is a folder classifier. In other words, if it shows up in this folder and you just give it an explicit path, it's automatically going to be classified as this type of information. I can create a custom classifier using Windows PowerShell, which is very powerful. What we're going to look at today, though, is a content classifier. I'm going to look at content, in other words, reading into the actual document itself. Anytime that that matches, I'm going to set the personally identifiable information property, right there, value to high. And again, remembering back, these get stored in Active Directory, so I don't have to create these in every file server. You create them once in AD, and then you push them out to your file servers. And then I can configure what the rule actually is. For anybody that's a regular expression fan, this makes sense. If you're not a regular expression fan, trust me that this is the regular expression pattern for a very rudimentary credit card. There's no anybody that is a regex person. There's no validation. I wouldn't use this in real life. But it works for this 4-4-4-4 pattern. So I've set that there. So anytime that pattern, that 4-4-4-4 pattern, is found in a document on my file server, I'm going to automatically set the personally identifiable information value or property to high. Which is great. That doesn't do much good, though, unless we have something to take action after the fact. So we couple this with a file management task. The file management task that I've created is all about encryption. So again, I define a scope, and then I look for condition. I look for that property value, personally identifiable information set to high. If I see that, I pick an action. What I've chosen to do is actually do a manual encryption. So rather than using a template, I've just elected to do this. So I'm manually saying that if you match that process, finance users get read access and finance admins get full control. Okay? So let's take a look at what this actually looks like to the end user. So here I am. I'm actually going to log back onto my client as Ben. So here I am. I'm on my desktop in a second. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to go to my finance folder. Now remember, Ashley didn't have access to this finance folder. This is the same folder share that Ashley went to and didn't have access. Because Ben's department attribute in Active Directory is set to finance, he has access. So I've got this folder, and I need to create a new document. So I'm going to go ahead and create an Excel spreadsheet. I'm going to go ahead and open this up and edit it. They get nagged about not activating it. All right. New credit card information. Oops. I'm going to go ahead and create a fake credit card number, obviously. I'm going to go ahead and save this. Notice again, I didn't apply rights protection. I didn't go in and manually create a classification. I didn't set this to be highly important personally identifiable information. And we're going to give this a second. I mentioned that there are a couple differences between how Windows 2008 R2 does this and how Windows Server 2012 does it. In Windows Server 2008 R2, you have the ability to do this automatic classification. The difference is that in Windows 2008 R2, that classification happens on a once-a-day process. Once a day, the file server has a schedule that it goes through, and it checks every single file on the file server and determines what should this classification be and do I have any rules to run on it. In Windows Server 2012, we've made a significant improvement in that we do what we call continuous classification. So as soon as a particular piece of information hits the file server, it automatically gets scanned and classified and, if necessary, has rules run on it. Now, I don't know if you guys noticed that. When I just hit refresh, that credit records file that I've just been working with, its size jumped up. It went from like 10 kilobytes to 124 kilobytes. I know, because it's me, that that means it's done. It's encrypted because ADRMS encryption adds a little bit of space. if we look at the properties of this, remember, I see a classification tab. We talked about that earlier. I now see that this personally identifiable information property now has a value set to high. I can also go ahead and open this up. If I open this up, Excel is going to start and say, oh, you know what? It's RMS protected. So it's going to ask me to sign in. And now you see that I have basically an option set that this has RMS protection set on it. Okay? So again, it's looking at information protection from the perspective of both the end user, but also as well as the IT pro. But what we want to do is really look at how can we give you guys as IT pros the tools that you need to help your data, to help your users protect their data without extra steps. How do we make it easy and automatic and painless for both you and for them? So quick wrap up on dynamic access control. Again, it's about classification. In other words, how do we decide what information we have? It's about access control. So how do we set really granular specific access policies, but store them centrally? And by doing this, we also get cool stuff like access denied remediation. How can we do audit? In other words, how can we make sure we know who's using the important data on our systems, but not needing to know who's accessing all the data on our systems, because it may not matter. And then also adding RMS protection. Once we've classified the data and identified what data we have, how do we make sure that we keep that data safe? How do we keep it protected, whether it stays on the file server or it gets accidentally or intentionally copied off to some cloud service or a personal laptop? Dynamic access control, again, is a super great, huge technology that we've added in Windows Server 2012. There's a couple more sessions today, and I think there's a session later this week. We're actually going to talk about how Microsoft IT implemented dynamic access control internally, because we use it internally at Microsoft today. So if you're interested, you can check that out. Track resources. I will be down in the expo for probably the next few hours, and then at least for a few hours the rest of the week every day, if not the whole time. There's a booth down there in the Windows Server area called Active Directory and Dynamic Access Control. We'd love to talk to you there. Even though it's not obvious, we're also talking about things like Forefront Identity Manager in that booth. So if anybody's curious about identity management, come find me. And I'm just in general a Windows Server 2012 guy, so I'm always happy to help with that stuff too. Download the release candidate for Windows Server 2012. All the dynamic access control stuff we looked at is there. If you go out to Microsoft TechNet, there's lab guides that actually show you how to build most of the lab that I just showed you, the demo that I just showed you, in your own lab. There's a hands-on lab for dynamic access control, and there might be one for RMS, but I'm not sure. But there's definitely one for dynamic access control. Some resources. And please, 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 please do your evals. We love it. So I've got like somewhere between 5 and 8 minutes left for questions. I'm happy to take questions for the room, or if anybody wants to grab me one off, that's fine too. But thank you very, very much. Thank you for sitting through it. Thank you.